then orthodoxy begins to get subdivided into modern orthodoxy, then strict orthodoxy, and now there's something to the left of modern orthodoxy, open orthodoxy. And the biggest critics of open orthodoxy are none other than modern orthodoxy. And I don't want to get into all the detail because some of it is nasty, some of it is name-calling, but here is the thing. In some ways, open orthodoxy has some very, very good things. They talked about, for example, Midos, they talked about non-rejecting people. Very, very nice stuff. Sometimes, as you get more yeshivas, you tend to become more intolerant, more rejecting. You need to be open and accepting of people. Now, when it goes that direction, I think Baruch Hashem, I think it's perfectly fine. But what got worse and worse, and I think that people who were involved with it pulled away, is that they began to espouse theologies that were absolutely clear. For example, a very prominent open Orthodox rabbi testified in favor at a legislative hearing in Maine that gay marriage ought to be legalized. They thought that who are we to make the standard. Not only that, but an article was published saying that supporters of gay marriage are like the Maccabees, who stood up for religious freedom, and their cause is as noble as the Maccabean, who fought against Antiochus. Okay. Another fellow said that he thought that a religious rabbi, who was considered to be their biggest Talmud Chacham, said that Avraham Avinu, I mean, Chas V'Shalom to even say these words, Avraham Avinu and the Avos were really myths that were invented to teach the Jewish people foundations of faith. So here is the thing. When you talk about Avos Yisrael and accepting Jews, all that is Baruch Hashem, that is good. And indeed, we should take Mussar and try to incorporate in our own Avodas Hashem. But when people start denying the truth of the Torah, when people start saying that there are parts of the Torah that are not min hashamayim, when people say that the Torah reflects the prejudices of a particular time and it needs to change as society evolves, so you're simply dealing with kfira and yesodos v'emuna. So to answer your question very simply, when do you cross the line is essentially when you disparage or deny the yud gimel yikrei emuna. And I think that's where it is. So it's gone very, 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 very difficult. I mean, in many, many ways, what's called open orthodoxy is much less religious than was the conservative movement when it started. That's how bad it is. So it goes by the word orthodoxy. And that's besides the issue of women rabbis, partnership in Yonim, where women lead part of the davening. So many things. It's like a runaway train that is simply run off the tracks. So I would say the basic test is Yikrei Emunah. As long as you believe in Yikrei Emunah, so everything else can, what you think about Zionism, you think about other things that's you can still be from and Orthodox and everything else, and those are just my folks.
So you have to believe that the Marsim of Bereshis are at what point, I mean, like, so if the Rambam says in Moreh Nebuchim, which I'm not sure he does actually say that, like, the angels visiting Avram was allegorical. If you say that, are you not the curse?
Well, okay, so you're raising another question, which is really not the issue of modern Orthodox, actually, saying that is to say, let's say that I take positions that are found in Rishonim. They are found in Rishonim, but they are positions that a majority of the Rishonim reject. So you're raising the very important question, is there such a thing as a psak halacha in matters of faith? Can a courses be up to paskim halacha? By that I mean the following. Sometimes people say, oh, we can prove something from an early rishon. And the answer is, yeah, but we don't paskim like that early rishon. But here's the thing. In halacha l'maisa, clearly, once the halacha is you can't do something, I'm not allowed to go with a view, oh, let's go like Beis Hillel, or let's go, I can't say, I want to paskim like Beis Shammah, right? But some people argue that halacha is only shayach on action. Halacha is not shayach on matters of faith. And by that I mean that if something was not apikorsis for the Rambam's son to say, then it can't be apikorsis for me to say even if most poskim or most rabbis didn't agree with him. So that's a controversial issue. Meaning some people say that as long as there are makairis and rishonim for what you believe, even if the vast majority of later people didn't believe it, you might be mistaken. But it's not shayach to say you're an apikairis if Rav Avraham ben Arambam was not an apikairis. Others say, Rav Yashiv actually said, that the shame that there's a psak halacha in what you do l'maisa, there's also a psak halacha in what you're allowed to believe. So he would say, strangely enough, sounds like a strange position, that when Avraham ben Arambam said it, it was not apikorsis, but it might become apikorsis now, because the halacha was apikorsis. So that's a separate machlokas in which one can ask, is there such a thing as a definitive psak halacha on matters of hashkafa, on matters of belief, or as long as there are makoros, one can go with each one. Now, that is an important question, but the problem is that open orthodoxy has gone beyond it. Right? In other words, maybe at some point they were saying, oh, we have Rishonim. Now it's gone how much chusul machana. And this is really an example, really, of when you try to make your boundaries too wide, although that may be a good thing in some ways, you wind up having no boundaries at all. And if you accept every type of belief, then you actually don't believe in anything. So they really have reached that point. I mean, I'll tell you a little you know, secret. Should not go beyond this room. I'm sure. the flagship school of Open Orthodoxy is Chol HaTorah, YCT, Yeshiva Chol HaTorah. And initially, this was more than 10 years ago, initially I was some little involved because there were some good things that they were doing. There are some good things that they're doing. Like everything else, there are good things that they're doing. But at some point, you know, it was not shy. I just had to separate from it. So, and I think quite a few people made the same decision.
Can you please tell us the halakhot of doing kriya at the kotel?
Yeah, the halakhot are not as pashut as you might think. Of course, you're asking me questions, so I imagine you've seen them, not so pashut. There is a din. That when you see Yerushalayim, let's say you're coming from America, you see Yerushalayim, the first time you do Kriya, you rip your garment over your heart, and then there's another halacha when you see the Harabayas, you rip Kriya. Our minhag is that we only do one Kriya for the Harabayas itself, but there's a lot of different questions. What do we mean by the Harabayas? Do we mean the Kotel? Because the Kotel is the outer wall of the Harabayas. Or do we actually mean you have to see over the wall, onto the floor itself? That itself is a machloka. Some say you don't do kriya unless you actually see the harabayas. Others say when you see the wall of the harabayas, either from Mount Scopus or from just when you come to the Kotel, you rip your garment. Now, this is a halacha, and according to the halacha, every 30 days you have to rip your garment, meaning this would mean if you didn't see the Kotel for 30 days, you'd have to rip your garment again. Now, this is a halacha. Obviously, most people that we know do not follow this halacha all the time, or they follow it sporadically. So let me just explain some of the shaylos. So first of all, there are days in which, because they're considered to be festive days, even if you see the Western Wall, you're not supposed to rip your garment. You don't rip your garment on Rosh Chodesh. You don't rip your garment on Shabbos Yom Tov. It's obvious, but even Chol HaMoed. Chol HaMoed, Rosh Chodesh, you don't rip. There is a minhag that many people have, that even on Erev Shabbos, if it's after Chatzos, after the middle of the day, they don't rip the garment. Rav Yashiv said that was a mistake, and you are mechuyev. Okay, but on the other hand, some poskim say not, and many people follow that in the sense that therefore they want to be sure that the first time they see the Kotel would be Erev Shabbos after Chatzos, and as a result, they would be exempt from kriya. Again, other poskim say not. Now, what about the 30 days? I mean, let's ask it practically. Let's say I go to the Kotel. Let's say the first time I come to Israel, I rip my garments. The proper thing to do. I'll discuss how you rip it. Then I don't see the Kotel for 30 days. So there actually is a psak from Rebbe Yashiv, another poskim say it as well, that if you live in Yerushalayim, if you are a person who lives in Yerushalayim, then you're not mechuyav to rip kriya even if more than 30 days becomes five, because you actually live in the makom hamikdash, and it's only for visitors. Now, if you came from Tel Aviv, you would have to rip every 30 days, but now that you live in Yerushalayim, that includes the year that you're living here, or the 2 years or more in yeshiva. Of course, he gave a bit of a biting reason, by the way, it's an interesting reason. He said, you know, the whole concept of ripping is that I'm so overwhelmed with grief that I rip my garment. But he says, you live in Yerushalayim and you didn't see the kussel for 30 days, and you live here. He says, maybe it doesn't bother you so much. That's what he says. So you don't rip, but I'm so broken up over it. Okay. Although you might say, sorry for care. They say, we showed that disc, you never went to the kussel because he was so overwhelmed with sorrow that he almost died, so he couldn't go to the kussel because it was too overwhelming for him. So one hetzer, and I'll talk about should you have a hetzer, but one hetzer is, as I say, Rosh Chodesh, Chol HaMoed, or even Erev Shabbos after Chatzos. Another hetzer is that if you're wearing a garment that does not belong to you, you're wearing a borrowed garment, you're not mechuyev in kriya. So that could mean if I borrow your shirt, I'm pleasure. But if you've learned in Kedushin, it's fairly easy that even without, you know, using your clothing, I could be mocked down my shirt to you by a Kenyan Chalipa, meaning to say, you give me a pad or a handkerchief, in exchange for which I give you my shirt, which I'm still wearing. So the shirt that I'm wearing is actually your shirt, although I'm wearing it, and that way I would be Pater from Kriya. So that's a way of getting out. Now the question, of course, we have to ask ourselves is, spiritually, is it good? So if you're looking for a way out, you can certainly have a way out. That's fine. The question is, should we be looking for a way out? And again, that's not so pleasant. One would think that at least once, the first time that you come at least, one should try to be Makai in the midst of Kriya, because you're expressing the yearning and the suffering over the Beis HaMikdash, and that's an important thing. To look for ways out implies I don't really care that much. It doesn't make a difference to me. So although I would understand that, you know, every time you go, you don't rip, and indeed, as Rabbi Yosher said, at least if you're living in your way, you're not mechuyev to do that. But one should try not to get out the first time, trying to do it. But that's basically it, that although Medina de Gemara, you would rip on both Yerushalayim separately and on the Temple Mount separately. I mean, I guess we just do it for the Temple Mount. Yeah.
I wanted to know in regards to nowadays that we have technology and things are moving towards computer chips and stuff like that. If there's the big philosophical question that if you have like a robot and you could do a brain transplant, put the brain in a robot, and get all the memories and all the thoughts and all the neural things that were going on in the human, what would happen? And coupled with that, AI, artificial intelligence, how does that connect from a Jewish... Would it be possible to create a thinking, a robot that thinks smarter than us, in a sense?
Well, you can certainly have things that are smarter than us, and any computer can do things much faster than most human beings.
I'm saying, let's say, bring Chidushim and Torah.
Well...
Because that's like...
The difficult question is... Really, ultimately, the question is, what is a soul? Really, that's actually the religious philosophical question. There is a brain, which is the mind that is capable of doing things, and that is a matter of neurons and electrical impulses, and to some degree, that can be simulated, and that can be duplicated, and in some levels, it can be improved. But let's imagine if you were able to transfer that type of brain to a machine. Would that machine have a soul? If, for example, I destroyed a machine, am I guilty of murder? Have I killed something? And what is a soul? And what is the notion of the divine image of man? Now, it's true that we often define the divine image of man, the neshama, as connected to the capacity to talk and the capacity to think. But this is hard to understand. That is not the essence of the soul. That is just a manifestation of the soul. You guys are learning Tanya, so I'm allowed to mention Tanya here. I couldn't mention otherwise, but now we have a license. But Tanya always talks about thought, speech, and action as the garments of the soul. Now, I don't know if you think of that as a very interesting expression. In other words, my what makes me and have a neshama is not that I'm able to think. Thinking is an attribute, it's a garment of the soul, but it's not an essence of the soul. And that would therefore mean that even if a machine would be capable of thinking, it would not have the divine spark that makes it a soul. So what is a soul? What is a disembodied theoretical soul? It's very hard to define, because all the things that souls do are simply attributes or garments. It's not the essential. The essential is the spark of Hashem. Now, we have all sorts of artificial people. We have golems, right, in our tradition. And yet, those golems also are not divine. They do not have divinity. They're just mechanical. They're like low-tech robots. I mean, they weren't made by high technology, but they are robots, essentially, that are capable of movement and action. Now, one question you might ask, which is a related question, is vis-a-vis two human beings, what if you had a brain transplant? That is an interesting question, because there you have two human beings, each of whom has divine souls. Let's say one person dies, but we could do a brain transplant in which I would have all of his memories, all of his experiences. Would I be him, or would I be me? For example, would I be married to his wife and no longer married to my wife? That's an interesting question. How do you define the identity of a human being? I mean, after all, one would think that a brain would be much more significant than a face. By the way, they've already done a face transplant. You know that there was a face transplant done in France. Like he was a severe burn victim or something, and they actually gave him somebody else's face, the face of obviously a person who died. It's interesting. Now, it would appear, though, that even though a face seems to be so indicative of a person, but in reality, it does not give him a new identity. Meaning, if my face looks like somebody else, I am still me. But a brain transplant might raise a different question.
Yeah. Is there any issue with having pictures of the sun, moon, or stars? What about like 3D things? You want to have like a globe of the moon? Is that an issue?
There might be issues. According to the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah and the Masechet Avodah Zarah, we are not supposed to have images of human beings and of celestial bodies like the sun, the moon, and the stars. Now, one thing I can tell you, which makes it easy, is that the halacha is that anything two-dimensional actually is permitted. So if you're talking about paintings, photographs, pictures, no problem, you can have all of that. Once you're dealing with three-dimensional, there is a problem. Now, let me point out that a typical globe of the Earth, remember you used to have globes as kids, so globes of the Earth are not a problem, because although it's the shape of the Earth, so to speak, but it's not really a representation. You have countries that are labeled this and that. In other words, it has to be, just like a human form, would have to be anatomically precise, in some sense, not just the face, but the entire body, which would be rare. A moon, theoretically, I haven't seen globes of the moon, but theoretically, I imagine it may look more like the moon, with craters. And
it's labeled like the Earth.
Say what?
They're labeled like the Earth. This text
if it's labeled, I think that already would negate the prohibition.
Okay.
There is even an issue that Post can discuss about dolls, because a doll might be a human form. So again, Rav Avi Yosef has a tshuva that he permits dolls, because number one, they're very rarely, if ever, anatomically exact in all detail. And number two, he has another heter that we're making today, because these things are not used as objects of Avodah Zarah, because the yisod of the Yisr was Avodah Zarah, and that might even be a heter for the moon, etc. The Kairos Yisr was when these things were worshipped as idols. But I do remember a story about the Chafetz Chaim. You know, the Chafetz Chaim had a second wife, had a daughter when he was very old, Bas Sukuna. She only died a few years ago. The Chaim's youngest daughter died maybe 10 years ago. And she used to reminisce about what it was like living with the Chafetz Chaim. Very, very interesting. The Chafetz Chaim was already an old person, and he was already a very famous gadol. And she talks about the fact that he was actually a very permissive father. He was not a strict disciplinarian. They could sit in his seat, and they could fool around, etc. But the one thing he was very machmed on is the children could never say a lie. They only could speak the truth. So she says she was once going out at night. I don't know, for Radna, I don't know what big entertainment there was in Radna, but she was going out to spend time with friends. So the Chavetz Chaim asked her if, you know, he had a bunch of Mishnah brewers on the table that he was going to send out for distribution. And sometimes, you know, when a sefer is printed, there are blank pages. The print didn't go through. So he just asked her, could you just thumb through a few sets to be sure there are no blank pages? So he asked her to go through six sets. So six sets would be 36 volumes. Now, again, she didn't have to read anything. She just had to be sure there were no blank pages. So, you know, it shouldn't take that long. So she said to her father, she said, can't do it now. When I get home, I can do 100 sets, but I can't do it now. So she comes home 3 hours later, and there are 100 sets of Mishnah Berurah, 600 volumes of Mishnah Berurah that she has to go through. So she says, you know, Abba, you told, all I had to do was like, you know, 10 sets. How do I have 100 sets? A person cannot lie. You say whatever you say, you have to fulfill. That was the one thing he was very strict on. That she had to be MS. And then she told another story that sometimes when she wanted to go away, because her, you know, her father was such a tzaddik, and she wanted to live in Mabel, so she would spend time in the town cemetery. Chavetz Chaim was a Kohen. He could not go into the so she said, "We go to the Beis HaKvaros in Radna." She's a Bas Kohen, is allowed to go to the cemetery. And then, but the reason I'm bringing this up is she told the third story that she once got a beautiful doll from a relative in America, and she showed her father the doll, and her father took out a penknife, and because it's a human form, he felt he had to cut off a tip of the nose. That's mutilation, as I had there. Or part of the ear. So she said that she didn't know what, she didn't understand that at all, but she said she was crying, whatever it is. Comforted her. So the Chavetz Chaim, at least in his own home, was apparently machmir on dolls. But Rav Avadya says we can be makel because they're not anatomically yet.
In terms of Kirov, the phrase makarving a person is like pulling off a you know, a Jew from the train tracks in Auschwitz and has the day of Pekuch Nefesh. How much do we hold of that?
Certainly, and on some level, the Gemara says causing somebody to sin is worse than even murdering them, and consequently, bringing somebody back to the path of Tshuva is as if you're giving them life, taking them off the train. And that's a wonderful thing. On the other hand, it's also very, very clear that it's not mamish because for the following reason. If you're eating tray for your Machal Shabbos, I'm not allowed to get into a car and be Machal Shabbos in order to save you, right? Number one, that would be almost illogical. For eventual Shabbos, I'll be Machal Shabbos. And I think the difference is this. The difference is that when somebody's dead, they're dead. When somebody's sinning, even though sin is worse than death, but potentially, even if I'm not makarv you today, I can do it tomorrow. So consequently, the need to do it on Shabbos is not justifiable because you can be misaking it by getting the person. So in the long run, certainly being machzer somebody to tshuva is considered to be a matter of pikuach nefesh, but it's not the type of pikuach nefesh that can be dochen. Prohibitions. I cannot violate prohibitions in order to be retired. On the other hand, I will tell you this, where the nature of somebody going off the derech seems to have been a permanent risk, the poskim actually did permit it. For example, Rav Chaim basically said that when somebody else was being taken to a monastery or was being taken to be converted to Christianity, I would be allowed to be mechalel Shabbos to get him out. The difference is that if it's a type of scenario where he'd be leaving Judaism and it's very less likely that he would come back, that is pikuach nefesh. Mashen came, a person who is a Jew, but he's just not yet keeping mitzvahs, so I can try to do my kirov after Shabbos. I'm not allowed to leave a house. So it's an in-between scenario. In other words, certainly it is an inyan of pikuach nefesh, but it's not usually going to be so kind of
I was going to raise the question, so Noel's question about the brain. Is a Siamese twin considered to have two souls or one soul?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And actually, the Chari is a Gemara about this mamish. The Gemara talks about somebody asked the Shaila that they have a if they would have a son with two heads who was their firstborn, would they give 5 saloim to a Kohen or 10 saloim? So they kicked him out of the basement. Everybody asking stupid, ridiculous questions. Right after they kicked him out, somebody walked in with two heads. The check who I put on spelling. And now apparently this was a Siamese twins. And basically, the halacha is like this. It really depends. If you have two functioning brains, even if they share common vital organs, like one heart and the like, they are halachically treated as two people. And their mitzvahs are, each of them are chayiv in mitzvahs. Now, I don't know if there's ever been a case, I doubt it. There's never been a case of a man-woman Siamese twin. I don't think that's shaykh. But theoretically, if it would be a man and a woman, the man would be chayiv in mitzvahs ki'ish, and the woman half would be chayiv in mitzvahs ki'isha. So they are treated as two people. You know, I remember reading, and I guess they're still alive, a pair of Siamese twins. By now they're probably 22 years old, and they lived together, you know, for all these years, and each of them has separate driver's license, you know, etc., and the like. Now, the fact that they're considered two people actually makes a very, very difficult halachic problem. That is, when you have babies, let's say, they're Siamese twins, today they're called conjoined twins, the reason they're called Siamese is because the first ones in modern times that survived till adulthood were from Thailand, and Thailand used to be called Siam, the term Siamese twin, but conjoined twins is the more politically correct term that we use today. And the issue is this. The issue is sometimes, because you only have one heart that is circulating blood in two bodies, the heart is not strong enough to keep both of them alive. So if you do nothing, they're both going to die. So what a surgeon will recommend is cut off one of the twins and give the heart or keep the heart in the body of one. And in that way, instead of two children dying, there's at least a chance that one of them is going to die. Now, there was actually a case in the 1970s, quite a long time ago already, in which a religious couple in Lakewood, a firm couple in Lakewood, had conjoined twins. And the surgeon basically said, if we do not surgically remove one of those twins, both of these babies are going to die in a few days. If we remove, it's still very high-risk surgery. It doesn't mean the other one will live, but the other one might live. So we advise that we do a surgery so that one will live instead of both of them dying. The parents said, we can't agree with this unless we first get a psak from a gadol. And they asked Rav Moshe Feinstein. And what is very strange is, Rav Moshe Feinstein prosecuted to do the operation. But what's interesting is, in spite of the many volumes of Igros Moshe that we have, there is no tshuva. Rav Moshe did not write a tshuva about this. And the only source, this is the most bizarre thing, the only source of how we know Rav Moshe's psak is from the newspaper report in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It's obviously not necessarily the best makor, but do you understand what the shaila is? The shaila is like this. The shaila is that normally you cannot kill one person to save another person. If goyim go over to a city and say, give us somebody to kill, we want to kill a Jew, or we're going to wipe out the whole city, the halacha is that even for bikuach nefesh, we're not allowed to murder one person to save other people. Okay, that's the Ahari Gvial Yavar. So, now if we would have said conceptually that conjoined twins are only one person, then in a sense, cutting away one twin would just be like cutting away some bone. That would be totally permitted. But since they're two people, we now have the problem, how do you kill one to save the other? Now you might answer, well, wait a second here. I'm not killing one to save the other. If I don't kill one, they're both going to die. So one of them is going to die anyway.
He's going to die sooner than...
Maybe sooner, okay, that's one issue. But that's not a good terrorist either. Because, all right, one of them is going to die. I mean, they're both going to die if you do nothing. But each side could say, why are you killing me to save him? Kill him to save me. So if each side has equal claim, you can't do anything. You can also say, Rodev, well, no, you're a Rodev. You're killing me. No, you're killing me. In other words, it's like a lifeboat. If a lifeboat could support 10 people, but if there's 11 people on the lifeboat, it's going to sink. And there are 11 people who jumped off the Titanic. Now, you could say number 11 is a Rodev. So if we knew who was number 11, you understand, we would be allowed to throw number 11 over the ship. We'd be allowed to do that. Because number 11 is Mesaken, the lives of 1 to 10. But when they all jumped at the same time, you can't say who is number 11. Each guy you want to throw over can say, hey, why am I called the Rodev? Maybe he's called the Rodev. And in such a situation, you can't do anything. So that was the big Shiloh. So Rav Moshe is still not Machadit. Again, Rav Moshe's Svara was that usually we say that the heart is physically in one body cat. It's very rarely mamish in the middle, and therefore we consider the heart as belonging to the one that has it, and the other one is the parasite, the other one is the rodent. The example would be, if I jump out of a, let's say two of us jump out of an airplane, and we both have parachutes, your parachute doesn't work. No, unfortunately. So in panic, you grab onto my leg. But unfortunately, with that extra weight, we would both crash and die. So since the parachute belonged to me, I look at you as a rodent taking away my parachute. I can, yes, you don't have to do such a thing, but I would be able to kick you off because you are a rodent. So Rav Moshe said that that's the situation with the babies, in which one baby essentially is robbing the heart from the other baby, and therefore you're allowed to look at them as a rodent. Now, that would mean that Lu Yitzur, the heart would be equally positioned, and maybe that never happened, and both babies would have an equal chance of survival, you would actually have to let them both die. Right, so I'm just bringing, this is a bit of a digression, I'm just bringing this in to show that the notion of dual personhood creates this very difficult rodent problem. Had they not been dual personhood, it would just be getting rid of some surplus stuff, that would not be a problem.
How do you argue someone who's saying that the way, like, Haredi or Orthodox way of living today has become sort of like man-made with all the like heterium and stuff that Gedolim can make, and say that like we're going too far off track from what like God wanted, from what Hashem commanded us, and it's becoming like too man-made? How do you like argue with someone that no, it's still actually in the boundaries of what Hashem wanted of them?
Well, you know, again, I mean, there may always be specific criticisms, and I'm not saying that they're not always legitimate. Meaning, my gut reaction is not that no matter what any question somebody asks, they're going to be wrong. Sometimes they might be right, and there might be things in contemporary from world that aren't so great. You know, that's not such a problem. But overall, I think for Kirk, when we talk about Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat, so part of the question is, why did Hashem want so much of the Torah to be oral? Why didn't we just write, you know, make the written Torah much bigger than it is? Like we have the Gemara, everything else. And part of it is, that the Ran says, is, and this may sound a little like reform, but Chas v'Shalom, but it's not. I mean, the Ran explains that although the Torah is eternal, the Torah is eternal, but life changes all the time. The life of the 21st century is not the same physical and material life as the life of the first century. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us principles, but he left it to the great Chachamim and people of divine inspiration to be able to take those eternal principles and apply them to life that changes all the time. So the very fact that things are man-made is really part of Hashem's plan. Now, Kodesh Baruch Hu wanted, as it were, to give us the foundations and then leave it to the Chachamim to work out the implications of those foundations. That is the Ratzon Hashem. The Ratzon Hashem is that we become his partners. I give a mashal very often, forgive me if you've heard it before, about baking a cake.
You know, let's say you want, you or your wife would want to bake a cake for your child, their birthday, a four-year-old. Now, the easiest way to bake the cake is when the child is asleep, you make the cake. Now, easy, 20 minutes, no problem. But a deeper way of showing your love with your child is you make the cake with them. Now, if you make a cake with a child, with a kid, it's going to be very messy. The kitchen will be messy. There'll be sugar on the floor. There'll be chocolate on the table. There'll be pieces of eggshell. The cake is not going to be even. You could have done a much better job by yourself. But you show love by your relationship. Hashem could have given us a Torah in which every single question would have a definite answer. You know, can you use electricity on Shabbos? Surrogate motherhood, genetic engineering. Instead, what did HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? He gave us principles, and he left it to the Chachamim of every generation to try to figure that out. That's why there's so much machlokas. People ask, one of the famous questions people ask is, if the oral law was given by Hashem to Moshe, how could there be arguments? One person says kosher, one person says trade. What did Hashem say? Did Hashem say kosher? Did Hashem say trade? It's a very good question. How could there be machlokes if the oral law was given by Hashem to Moshe? The answer to that is that we actually misunderstand, I think. What do we mean the oral law was given by Hashem to Moshe? When we say the oral law was given by Hashem to Moshe, we don't mean every line of the Gemara was given by Hashem to Moshe. If that's so, you'd have the absurdity that Abaye and Rava are reading from the script. I mean, I read a page of Gemara. Abaye says this, Rava says this, Rav Huna says this. You're telling me this was handed down? Did Abaye get a piece of paper that said, Abaye, you say this, and Rav Huna, you say this, and say it with a lot of enthusiasm, and you should go. Clearly, what went on in the Beis Medrash of Abaye and Rava is the same thing that goes on in the center Beis Medrash, although people who were, excuse me for saying so, much greater. myself as well. In other words, Hashem didn't tell you what to say. Right? You think what you're going to say. Abaye is the same thing. So what do we mean when we say the oral law was given by Hashem? Hashem gave the Kolim and the Yesodos, out of which all questions can be addressed. But as the Rambam writes, two people that have the same Kolim might legitimately come to different conclusions. And therefore, when we say the oral law was given by Hashem, we mean the foundation out of which all debates occur. So B'kitzer, I mean, my short answer to you is that Hashem wanted an interactive Torah. Hashem wanted Klal Yisrael, through his Chachamim, to be actively involved in implementing the Ratzon. That is the Ratzon of Hashem. Ad kidei kach, that we even have a rule, lo b'shamayimi, that even if Hashem says the halacha is not like you, if a majority of the Chachamim disagree, they tell Hashem, sorry, we don't listen.
So even if it would be that Chas v'Shalom, Chazal somewhere, majority of people went in the wrong way, that's now become like the right way.
That's correct. That becomes the will of Hashem. It is Hashem's will. That's exactly the Gemara in Bava Metzia, where a majority of the Chachamim Paskin Tameh, and Rabbi Eliezer said Tor, and a voice from heaven said Tor. And the Chachamim said, sorry, Lo B'Shamayim, you said in the Torah, we follow the majority, we're following your rules, and that sounds like a big chutzpah. And someone asked Eliyahu HaNavi, what did Hashem do? What did he say? Sorry, Hashem, we're not listening. He says, Hashem laughed, and he said, Nitzchuni Banai, my children have been victorious.
How do we know, like, these days, like, in those days, I'm sure they had a way of choosing Chazal and who they're running. These days, like, I'm not like doubting it or anything.
That's outside
the community. How would I believe you that these are the good arguments?
Okay, now that's a different question. Now that is a very, very excellent question. That is, okay, obviously we're not saying anybody that's a rabbi or anybody, you know, has this particular koach. We're referring to the great gedolim. And then you ask a very good question. What makes somebody a gadol? Right? You just hang up your shingle and say, gadol hador, or whatever it would be. It is a good question. Generally speaking, what we say is, and it's
not a perfect answer, is that Gedolim are those that are accepted by other Gedolim as Gedolim, meaning to say, sometimes it takes one to know one. Gedolim, who are machshiv somebody as a Gedol, he becomes a Gedol, but of course, how do you know the first Gedol, etc. But I'll tell you this, you know, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for some, I don't know why he did this, but in the 1960s, the New York Times wanted to interview him. Because they heard he was like the biggest rabbi in America, they wanted. So for some reason he agreed to give him an interview. So somebody had the reporter ask him, how come everybody asks you shilas, or questions? Like, you know, why do they go to you? So he said, in his very modest and sweet way, he said, you know, it just starts. One person asks you a question, and they think it's a good answer, so they tell other people to ask. Well, eventually, a lot of people come. So a gadol is somebody number one. So I'll give you a short list. A gadol is somebody number one who has tremendous knowledge of Torah. Now that's not the only thing, though. There are professors who have tremendous knowledge of human religion. A gadol is somebody who is humble. He does not look for cuddles. A gadol is somebody who has avas Yisrael, and a gadol is somebody who has a sense of responsibility for Klal Yisrael. So all I can tell you is, a person who does not have avas Yisrael, a person who doesn't have a sense of achrayus from Yisrael, a person who is not a yorei shemayim, a person who is not great in his knowledge of Torah, even though he might be great in some other ways, might be a great person in some other ways, could not be a gadol. So basically, most of the time, you can tell if somebody is a gadol b'torah or not. You know, I can tell you, but ultimately, you know, it cannot be reduced to a fixed rule because gadolim have different personalities as well. Right? Some gadolim are fiery, and some gadolim are gentle. Some gadolim are strict, more midas hadin, and some are midas harachamim. Right? So you can't. But I would think the common denominator is greatness. Is greatness in Torah, tremendous hasmana. Midos, Yiras Shemayim, Avas Yisrael, and Achrayis. Achrayis is an important thing. Achrayis is when you have a sense that, you know, of responsibility to Am Yisrael. You don't just care about yourself, but, you know, you really have a sense of Achrayis to the nation. And then we believe that Hashem gives such people special divine assistance to come up with the decisions that are best for them.
What's the outlook on using a computer for Torah study in terms of like making connections, or and then maybe more extreme, like looking things up, like events that happened?
Are you talking about using search engines for Torah research, or are you talking about looking at current events to connect it to Torah?
I guess both. If that's
okay, so like this. You know, now we have, you know, on the internet and through CDs and other types of things, we have these amazing search engines which have scanned and indexed thousands of volumes. If you want to know, for example, where something is in the Gemara, not even in the Tshuva, you type in the words and you'll get back all of the references. Of course, when Bar-Ilan University developed the best one, Bar-Ilan as a search engine. It's interesting, when they wanted to test how great their search engine was, they submitted a shaila to Ravadi Yosef and they asked him, can you list all of the responsa that mentioned this idea? And then they ran it through their search engine. He came up with 10 references, they came up with 9. So they actually ran an advertisement. We are so good that we got 90% of a retro Ravadi. That was a boast. But okay. So here's the thing. There is nothing wrong with using computer-aided research. I bet you that if you went to Art Scroll when they were translating the Shafts, their writers and translators use it. It's perfectly fine. But you have to understand, like everything else, these are crutches. The Iker in Torah is our work, our Yigiyah. Now, good. If you're looking for something to get references, to get Mara Makomos, that's fine. There's no mitzvah of Yigiyah to kill yourself in finding where things are. That's a superficial Yigiyah. And if you can make those things easier, that's okay. I mean, if somebody tells you, no, you have to be Miyageya to pull 30 books out of the shelf, that's not Yigiyah material. If you can do that by a computer thing, go ahead and do it. but you have to know that that can't be the end of your learning, that the ultimate learning is working on things, thinking about things. So like anything else, if you use it as a tool, there's nothing wrong with it. There is nothing wrong with it. Now, if you're asking me about using the internet for news, current events, putting aside the risks of internet anyway, if it's not filtered, which is a separate chakra vitaria, the idea of news, whether it's newspaper or internet, because you know, in the olden days it was newspapers, the same principle. I can tell you that many Gedolim felt it was proper to know what's going on in the world, but one shouldn't be obsessed with it. One shouldn't spend a lot of time with it. So, for example, there were great Rosh Hashivas who would read the headlines every day. They didn't have to read, some Gedolim would read the paper twice a week. They say, I don't have to know what happens minute by minute by minute. I just need a general overview. So I think it is good to know what's going on in the world. Number one, that gives you kavan in your tefillah, to be mispalel for a particular tzaras. And it also can be a vehicle, in some sense, where you see the hand of God, the hand of Hashem in Hashkacha Pratis. But it should always be a secondary. What was their story? When Rav Gifter, the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, was a bacher. So Rabbi Chaim Wasserman was visiting the United States in the 1930s. And Rav Gifter went to visit him in his hotel room. Rav Gifter was like 14. Rabbi Chaim was one of the Gedolei Hador. So he comes to Rabbi Chaim's hotel room, and he was shocked. He sees Rabbi Chaim reading a Yiddish newspaper. And Rav Gifter was really totally shocked. Rabbi Chanan said, you know, he says, Rabbi Chanan told him, a yid has to make time for two things. You got to finish Shas every year, and you read a paper every day. And the rest of the time you learn. The two side goals, you got to finish Shas every year, and read the paper every day. So that puts it in perspective. You know, if you do Shas every year, you can read the paper every day. That's